term is congruent numbers, but the word congruent does not mean what it normally means. It's an ancient term devised by apparently the ancient Arab mathematicians who were the first to apparently think about this question. And if you are interested in what I'm going to show you today, you can find more about it in a paper I've written over there. A gentleman named Keith Conrad wrote a paper you can Google, and it's a very easy read. And he tells you a lot of stuff that I don't tell you, and I'm going to tell you stuff that he doesn't tell you. And between the two of us, we cover a lot of ground. So what are congruent numbers? Well, we're going to look at, by the way, I'm terrible with this, so you have to shout at me, you know, up, down, whatever, so you can read it. We're going to look at, is that legible? Yes. We're going to look at triangles, right triangles, width alpha, height beta, hypotenuse gamma. They're going to be denoted that way, by a triple of numbers, alpha, beta, gamma, width, height, hypotenuse. And we're interested in the case that the size, alpha, beta, and gamma, are all rational numbers. And furthermore, the area happens to be an integer. So the area, of course, is 1/2 the width times the height. So when does that happen? Well, here's a few examples. Rational, rational, rational has the area 5. Rational, 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 area 6. Rational, 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 area 7. When that happens, n is called a congruent number. So 5, 6, and 7 are congruent numbers. Now, Fermat gave a lovely little proof that 1 is not a congruent number. You cannot find any rational right triangle with area 1. It's a lovely little proof. You can find it in Conrad's paper. And it's got historical interest because Fermat was the first person to use the principle of well ordering. He called it infinite descent. And the very first proof where he used it was in that proof. So I do highly recommend looking up that proof. It's a nice little read. It's also not too hard to show that the numbers between 1 and 12, the only congruent ones are 5, 6, and 7. The rest are not congruent. Okay? So there's some examples. Now we're going to be using Pythagorean triples. I'm sure you all know them, but just to remind you, I'm going to use Latin letters for integers and Greek for rational or real. So there is a Pythagorean triple. I should say, I'm going to be having just positive numbers in here. So that's true, making it a Pythagorean triple. Or I could think of it as a rational right triangle. So it's either a Pythagorean triple or a rational right triangle, an integral right triangle. Furthermore, this is said to be a primitive Pythagorean triple, as you no doubt know, if A and B are relatively prime, or equivalently A and C, or B and C. Let me remind you, again, you probably know that if I have a Pythagorean triple, then A and B cannot both be odd. How many know that fact? I'll give you a quick proof. Let's work mod 4. An odd number squared mod 4 must be 1. An even number squared mod 4 must be 0. So if A and B are both odd, I square them. Each turns out mod 4 to be 1. Their sum is 2 mod 4. But that side is either 0 or 1 mod 4. Okay? So either A or B must be even. And we're going to use that fact later on. Here's a lemma I'm going to use but not prove. I'm going to let you guys prove it yourselves. It's not hard. Suppose I have a rational right triangle of area n. And suppose I want to clear the denominators in those rational numbers. So I multiply through by the smallest positive integer such that m alpha, m beta, and m gamma are all integers. Then it's trivial to show that this turns out to be a Pythagorean triple, and the area is n times m squared. The multiplying through by m up the area by the factor of m squared. Here's the part we're going to need. It's slightly harder to prove, but not too hard. If it turns out, if n is also square free, you know what that means? That any prime that divides n only appears to the first power. Like 12 is not square free because it's 3 times 2 squared, okay? If n is square free, then in fact, not only is this a Pythagorean triple, but it's a primitive Pythagorean triple. We're going to use that lemma. I leave the proof to you. And here's an example. We looked at a picture of that triangle. It had area 5. And to clear denominators, I multiply through by m equals 6. And I get that, which turns out to be a primitive Pythagorean triple, and its area is 5 times 6 squared. Okay, now, here's the first thing I want to show. Conrad gives a
outlines a sophisticated proof of this, not giving a complete proof. I'm going to give you a complete proof of this first fact using just high school algebra. In fact, one reason why I wanted to give this talk is that the mathematics in it is sophisticated, but the calculations are just high school algebra. So it's a good illustration that mathematics is a lot more than just calculations. Most people make that confusion. They think, oh, calculations, that's mathematics. It's a lot more than that. And this paper, I will let... a brief interruption here. Maybe we should have pizza first and the talk after.
Wait, I guess we can pause for a minute for people to go up and grab some slices off.
Is an elementary proof that if you have a congruent number, so if there is one rational right triangle of area n, then in fact there's infinitely many of them. If it's not congruent, there's none. So either there's none or there's infinitely many. And then I'll show much, much more than that. So how am I going to prove that? Well, assuming it's n is congruent, there is a rational right triangle. Let's call it that of area n. And just like in the lemma 1 that I left to you, we clear denominators, giving us... Oh, I'm going to do this in the case that n is square-free. To get from the square-free case to the general case is dull. It's trivial. Very dull. So simple. I'll leave it to you. So, really, n square-free and congruent. I clear denominators in this rational right triangle to get this primitive Pythagorean triple. Okay? And I call it ABC. I'm now going to use a magic formula. Capital A, capital B, capital C. And capital M. Here it's small ABC and slower case M. Now, uppercase A, B, C, and M. And there's the formula. So capital A is that, capital B is that, capital C is that, and capital M is that. And the claim is that this is again a primitive Pythagorean triple, just like this one, and its area is that. So instead of n times little m squared, it's n times capital M squared. And once I will give you a proof of that. And once we prove that, we see that we can divide this through by capital M, giving this. And this will be a rational right triangle of area n. So I now have two of them, the one I began with and this new one. Well, are they really two? Maybe they're equal to each other. I will show they're not equal to each other. And to do that, I'm going to use the fact, well, I will prove that this capital M is bigger than little m, and we'll use that. Here's an example. Again, our old friend, the picture we saw of rational right triangle of area 5. We multiply through by m equals 6. We got that. So the magic formula says the capitals should be that. So when I plug these numbers into here, I get that. And you can check that that really is a primitive Pythagorean triple. And there's the formula for capital M. And it turns out to be that, which you can see is bigger than little m. So I now have two rational right triangles of area 5, the original one and this new one. And to show they're different, I'm going to use the fact that the capital M is smaller than the little m, and later I'll prove that is always true. So, suppose they were equal. Then the first two entries here would equal the first two entries here, giving me these equations. Cross multiplying, I get those equations. Now I'm going to use primitiveness. Remember, we started with a square-free n to get a primitive Pythagorean triple. So the capital M is just capital M times 1, but by primitiveness, 1 is that GCD, and I can move that M inside that GCD, and I can then replace those two things with those two things. That's what those two equations tell me. I then factor that little m out. That GCD is again 1 by primitiveness. I get rid of it, and I conclude that capital M equals little m, but that's a contradiction. You saw it was bigger. So I now have two of them of area 5. To get a third, well, I start with my second one and repeat the process. I clear denominators to get this. I use my magic formula. to get a third one. And the same, and the capital M prime will be bigger than the capital M. The same proof gives me a third one, then a fourth, and a fifth, and a sixth, and a seventh. Okay? Utterly simple argument. Let's do the mathematics. High school algebra. So here's what we're beginning with. Our primitive Pythagorean triple, whose area is n times little m squared. There's my magic formula. And the claim is that this is, again, a new thing is a primitive Pythagorean triple. Its area is that, and the capital M is smaller, is bigger than the small m. We're going to prove those in reverse order. The last one. Hey, look at the formula for capital M. It's got a little m hidden inside of it. I take the little m, I multiply it by 2. Then by something else. It's got to be bigger, of course. The only way it could fail to be bigger is if that other factor turned out to be 0. I leave that to you. It can't be. Well, A and B are not both. You have to prove yourself that they can't be 0. That's easy. So that part is true. Okay. Well, what do I need now? The area. Okay. Well, the there was the area of the original triangle. Multiplying that by 4, I get this equation. There's the area of the big triangle. But the capital A was this, and the capital B was this. So this equals this. And look at that 2AB. I can replace it by that. That gets me to here. I then factor that N out, and everything else in there is a square. And it happens to be capital M. There's the second part. Okay. The third part. I need a primitive Pythagorean triple. Well, for any integers x and y, this is a Pythagorean triple. That is trivial high school algebra. This squared plus that squared equals that squared. Trivial high school algebra. So for the x, I plug in c squared. For the y, I plug in 2ab, and this turns into this. So this, I know, is a Pythagorean triple. Now, I want to talk about this. Well, look at the last two entries there. They are identical to the last two entries here. So I only have to show the first entry here equals the first entry here. High school algebra. There's the first entry. C to the fourth, that's C squared squared. But C squared is A squared plus B squared. I get to here. From there to there, high school algebra. Okay, it's a Pythagorean triple. Primitive. I will show that the A and the C, the capital A and capital C, are relatively prime. If not, there would be a prime Q that divided both capital A and capital C. So Q would divide their difference. But there's their difference. There's the capital C, and there's the capital A. High school algebra gets me to that. So Q would divide that. So Q would have to either divide 8, making it 2, or it would divide A or B. But I remind you, we already know that either A or B is even. They cannot both be odd. So if Q is 2, it already divides either A or B. So in either case, Q divides either A or B, but it also divides A, which is the square of that thing. So Q divides that thing. So it divides either A or B and that thing. That tells me it divides both A and B, and that contradicts primitiveness. Utterly trivial high school algebra proof. And yet, there is some sophistication here. The sophistication is, where did this magic formula come from? Okay? How did you figure out that that's what you should use? Well, I should be able to tell you because I discovered that. Now, I'm sure I'm not the first person to discover it. I'm probably at least the 500th. But I did discover it, and I forget how, because it wasn't a logical step-by-step process. I hate it when I hear people talk about mathematicians and their linear reasoning. I want to throttle them. How I thought of that was I started thinking about these things, and I just kind of got this little fact and that little fact and little pieces of an elephant, but I didn't see the elephant. And after a week of just thinking about those little pieces, one afternoon I said, oh, that's giving me an elephant, and there's the elephant. And I said, that has to be true. And once I said it has to be true, the proof was trivial. So the sophisticated part was somehow seeing that elephant, seeing it was true, okay, knowing intuitively it was true, and then proving it was trivial. Okay, so if there is a single rational right triangle of area N, then there's infinitely many of them. But much, much, much more is true. And this is not at all in the Conrad paper. Let's think about all right triangles of area N. I don't care about rational anymore. Any size, real numbers. You might have a tall, skinny one. Or a short, wide one. or a kind of medium one, okay? Where here, let's think about the height. Pick any height beta, any positive number beta, real number. You can then pick the alpha and the gamma appropriately to make that be a right triangle of area n. So there's this continuum of right triangles of area n, going all the way from tall, skinny ones down to short, wide ones. Okay? But we know that infinitely many of those are rational. So I ask you, where are the rational ones? Are they all clustered near the tall, skinny end, or all clustered near the short, wide end? Or are they distributed kind of throughout? Well, I'm going to show you that they are distributed throughout. In fact, very, very, very evenly. To use a sophisticated term, I will show you that they are dense in that spectrum. Pick any right triangle of area n. Pick, you know, this one. I can find a rational one of area n that looks almost like that one. What do I mean by that? The height of my rational one will differ from the height of this one by as little as you want. Do you want it to be close within 1 millionth? I can do that. Within a billionth? I can do that. Within a trillionth? I can do that. And once you pick the height, the other two sides are determined, since you know it's a right triangle in this area n. So it's only the height you have to worry about. If you make the two heights equal, or almost equal, then the two shapes have to be almost equal. Okay? Everybody with me here? So you understand now what I want to do. All right. So here it is written down officially. Given any real right triangle of area n and any epsilon bigger than 0, I'm going to show you there is a rational right triangle of area n whose height differs from the arbitrary height by less than your epsilon. So this rational right triangle and this arbitrary right triangle must have shapes that are almost identical. Okay? So how am I going to do that? Well, here's the real sophistication in this talk. The thing about my elephant that I discovered was minor sophistication. Okay? Here is more major sophistication. We're going to work with this curve. I've got a picture of it drawn here. There's the whole thing. You can see that part, and there's that loop over there. We're not going to need that loop over there. We're just going to need the part starting here at x equals n. There's the origin down there. And that other point is minus n. Okay? We're just going to need this part. But that other part exists. I'm just going to talk about this part. I leave to you to think about the whole thing and figure out that there really is that loop there. There's also stuff in here, but you can't see it because it's imaginary. Okay. By the way, this type of curve is called an elliptic curve, and they are fascinating. There's all kinds of wonderful really deep mathematics involved with curves of this sort. If you want to learn about it, look at a book by Silverman and Tate called Rational Points on Elliptic Curves, I believe. Okay, let's get some basic facts. Because that y is y squared there, I can replace y by minus y, telling me it's symmetric. For any y here, there's a point and thing below there. So this xy appears matched by an x minus y down here. Okay. As I say, we're only going to take the part from x equals n onward. We're going to be mostly interested in this positive part. And there's its equation. Let's see here. And when I plug in n equals 0 into that, I get y equals the square root of 0. So I get n comma 0, which, by the way, is a rational point. What happens when x gets really big? When x gets really big, let's think about that. Suppose n is 1,000 and x is a trillion trillion. Then the x cubed is so much bigger than the other part, I can almost ignore the other part. And I'm really just talking about almost y equals the square root of x cubed. In other words, almost that. And we know what that looks like. As x gets bigger and bigger, it gets steeper and steeper and steeper and steeper and steeper and steeper and steeper. So the tangent line here begins vertical, then goes positive and gets smaller, and then gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And as you continue on, eventually tends back to becoming vertical. Okay, we're going to use that later on. Notation. In the rest of this talk, xy will always represent a point on the top half of this curve. So the x will always be equal to greater than n, and the y will always be that square root, putting it on this curve. You might see an x prime y prime, or an x sub 1 y sub 1. Okay, but any x paired with a y, you know what the y is. Okay? All right. And as I say, I leave as an exercise for you to figure out the rest of that picture, which I'm not going to talk about. By the way, we're going to be particularly interested in the rational points on this curve, where the x and y are both rational. Okay? So what's the connection between this curve and my triangles? And say this is the really sophisticated part of the talk. Conrad has a section talking about how someone might have discovered this connection. So I will leave that to you to read in the Conrad paper. So I take one of my right triangles of area N, and I define x to be that number and y to be that number. I then claim that the x is bigger than the n, and the y is exactly what I told you it would be earlier. So this point is going to be on that positive part of that curve, just like I told you it would be. And furthermore, the original triangle turns out to be given by that. So there's my, that's my alpha, that's my beta, that's my gamma. Furthermore, this will be a rational right triangle if and only if this is a rational point. So let's do that last part first. That's trivial. Suppose alpha, beta, gamma are all rational. Then look at the x. Everything in this is rational. Look at the y. Everything in this is rational. So the x and the y are rational. Other way around, equally easy. If x and y are both rational, look at that. That's rational, that's rational, that's rational. Okay? Okay, so the last part is trivial. The rest of it is, guess what? Easy high school algebra. But you have to remember that you have a right triangle here, and you have to remember that the area is n. So remember those two facts and do easy high school algebra. I'll do the first step. We wanted to show that the x is bigger than the n. So there's my x. I want to show it's bigger than n. But look, it's got an n in it. So I just have to show the rest of it is bigger than 1. So I'm going to square. I want to show that. Well, there's that square. I'm going to make that factor smaller. I make it smaller by making the denominator bigger. I've made the denominator bigger. Hey, high school algebra gets me to there. I remember I had right triangle. The Pythagorean theorem tells me the denominator here is beta squared. I get 1. Okay, so I'm done with that step. And the other steps, you know, there's a whole bunch of them, but they're all equally easy, trivial high school mathematics. Okay, now, so I'm going to change notation. I've been using alpha, beta, gamma as a triangle, but now I'm going to call it alpha of x, beta of x, gamma of x. So remember, we have my alpha, beta, here it is, my alpha, beta, gamma is really that. So saying, hey, that's really, I can write that in terms of x. After all, the y is just a function of x. So, you know, alpha is just a function of x, so is beta, so is gamma. So I'm going to exhibit it that way. So when I write that, I'm going to mean that triangle. Okay? So all I've really done is I've labeled all of my right triangles of area N, and for my set of labels, I've used the numbers x bigger than N. Okay? And I furthermore, the lemma furthermore told us, this will turn out to be a rational right triangle if and only if this is a rational point on the positive part of that curve. That was the easy part of that lemma that we did at the start, okay? Oh, by the way, how come x bigger than... What happens if x equals n? Remember when x equaled n, y equals 0, and this alpha of x turns out to be 0 over 0, and you don't want to talk about that. You could take the limit as x goes to 0. That turns out to be 0, but that gives you a right triangle of 0 width. You don't want to talk about that either, okay? So we don't let x equal n if I want to talk about a right triangle. But if I want to talk about a rational point, I must consider the possibility that x equals n, because that gives y equals 0, and that is the irrational point, and later on we'll have to worry a little bit about that, okay? Okay. So, but here's our basic lemma here. This is a rational right triangle if and only if this is a rational point. So I'm going to make an easy definition here. S will be the set of x is bigger than n such that this is a rational point. So now lemma 3, which earlier said this, it said this if and only if this, I can now throw on that extra line. This will be a rational right triangle if and only if x is in S. Now, when is this a rational point? That's the slightly more complicated case. Possibility one, if x is an S, then that's a rational point. But also if x equals n, then this is a rational point. Because when x equals n, this is n comma 0. Okay? So that's slightly more, that extra little wrinkle we have to remember. Okay? It's not hard to remember. Okay. Now, let's review what we wanted to show. Picking a random label and looking at this random right triangle of area N, I want to find a rational right triangle of area N. Somewhere there's an invisible of area N in here, in this sentence. A rational right triangle of area N that has almost the same shape as this. In other words, I want this height and that height to be arbitrarily close to each other. But remember, to be rational, to be a rational right triangle, I must have X and S. So what I really want to show is, if you pick this random height, I can find an X in S such that this height is arbitrarily close to your random height. Okay? Everybody with me here? Okay? But the next picture shows that to make this close to this, I just need to make X very close to X prime. So basically, in a moment we'll see this, we want to end up showing that S is dense in that. And you know what the word dense means, I hope. Okay? So here's why. There's my formula for beta of X. There it was. It becomes that. The Y was that. And we're taking X is bigger than N. So there's this graph. And it asymptotically, as X goes down towards N, it asymptotically goes to infinity. And here it goes asymptotically down to zero. And for your random X prime gives you that height. And this X gives you that height. So to make those two heights close to each other, just make the two X's close to each other. Okay? You could use the word continuity, but why? You know, it's obvious. All right. So, but remember, I also want X to be an S because I want to get a rational right triangle. So I also want X to be an S. So I want X to be very close to X prime and also be an S. So really, that's what I really want to show. No matter what X prime you pick, I can find an X in S arbitrarily close to your X prime density. Everybody happy? Okay. Well, if S is going to be dense, then it better be infinite. So let's begin by showing that it's infinite. Well, we already know that. Step one, what we already showed is that there's infinitely many rational right triangles of area N. And for each of them, the corresponding label X is in S. And since there's infinitely many of these rational thingies, there's going to be infinitely many X's in S. So step one is done, okay? X is infinite. That's good. Okay, the rest of this talk is going to use this notation and be talking about this picture. So X1 will be equal to or bigger than N. We have to worry about the case that it equals N, okay? And X2 is definitely bigger than that. So here is my X1, X2, and X3. Well, never mind X3. Ignore that for the moment. X1 and X2. I go up here to X1, Y1. X2, Y2 on the positive part of that curve. Over here, I don't go up. I go down to X1 minus Y1 down here. And then I draw the line connecting those two points, and I call it L. And I find its equation. Well, the slope. What's the slope? You know, connect that point to that point. The slope is given by that. The positive, the plus sign there because of that negative sign down here. Okay? So that's the slope. How do I find the y-intercept? Well, it passes through this point. So plug in y2 and x2 and solve for b and you get that. Okay? Utterly trivial high school math. Everybody happy? Okay. Now, the picture shows that this line will cross that curve in a third place. We're going to call X3, Y3. We're going to give a proof in a minute, maybe the most sophisticated proof that I give here, that actually you can actually prove that it does cross in a third place. But the proof, no, I'm not going to make that precise, but the proof I will show you contains hidden in it a proof that it actually does. There is one little exception. Suppose X2... Y2 was right about there. So this line just grazed, was tangential. Then the X2, Y2, and the X3, Y3 would be equal to each other. We will never need that case, but it could happen. Okay. Now, one more thing I need to mention. I started with that point, with this point, and this point, and then got that point. I could have started with this point, and this point, and my third point would have been this one. And we're going to play the game both ways. So this might be my x2, y2, and this might be my x3, y3. Okay? And we will use that possibility later. Here's the first two things I want to show you. I want to show you basically four things about this picture. The first two are that there is an easy formula for x3 in terms of x1 and x2. Given x1 and x2, there's an easy formula for x3. I will then show you that if this is a rational point, and this is a rational point, then so is this one. In fact, if any two of them are rational points, then so is the third one. Okay? And later on, I'll talk about the slope and how to make the slope of that line big. Okay. So the first step, let's find an easy formula for x3 in terms of x1 and x2. I claim it's that. I remind you, lambda was this, and the equation for L was given by this. So I want to find the places where the line L intersects that curve. So to do that, I plug this in for the y, giving me this equation. That's okay? And then I ask, what x's make that equation true? Well, the nice thing about this problem is I already know the answer. x1 makes it true, x2 makes it true, and x3 makes it true. Isn't it wonderful when you already know the answer to your problem? Okay? Makes life much easier. Well, this is equivalent to this. Again, I just moved things around, high school algebra. So I'm looking for the x's making this true. But I know what they are, x1, x2, and x3. Well, I now use a pretty easy fact that I hope you folks know. If you don't know it, look it up, learn it, ask me later, ask Dr. Daniels, find it somewhere. It's important, but it's very easy, actually. If you have a monic polynomial of this sort and you know all of its roots, you can say the original polynomial is that product. That's a standard easy fact. If you don't know it, find the proof. Ask somebody. It's easy. Figure it out yourself. It's not that hard. But it's a very useful, standard, easy proof. And basically, again, you can do it using nothing more than high school algebra. Okay? You could give that to a smart high school algebra class, and the smart kids in it would be able to solve it. Might give them a hint. Okay, I multiply this out. Well, I get x times x times x. It'll be an x cubed. And the x squared term turns out to be that. And then there's an x term which I don't care about and a constant I don't care about. So this equals this. Well, compare the x squared term here to the x squared term here. Look at their coefficients. Their coefficients must be equal. This must equal this. And from that, I get my formula. So there's an easy formula of x3 in terms of x1 and x2. Okay, now, the next part was, if two of the points were rational, then so is a third. So here's that lemma. If this point and that point are both rational, I don't care, plus or minus, doesn't matter what the sign is there. If this and this are rational, then so is that one. I'm going to restate that. Remember, this was rational if and only if x2 was an S. And this was rational if and only if either x1 is an S or that special case that x1 equaled N. Okay? So I'm going to prove this lemma by the top line, but I'm going to use it by the bottom line. Because they're equivalent. They say the same thing. Okay? Well, the proof is very simple. Suppose those are both rational. So all x1, x2, y1, y2 are all rational. Look at lambda. Everything in this rational is rational. Look at beta. Hey, the lambda is rational. These are rational. B. B is rational. Well, the lambda is rational. The x1 and x2 are rational. x3 is rational. Now, here's a little trick. Remember the y. The y had to be the square root. It involved the square root. That put it on that curve. Square roots are messy. But not only is it on the curve, it's also on the line. It's where the line and the curve intersect each other. So I don't worry about the equation for the curve. I go to the simpler equation for the line. This point is on that line. So this must be true. And I already know that the lambda is rational and the b is rational. So y3 is rational. So this is rational. So x3 is an S like I wanted. Okay? Everybody happy? Okay. Now, slopes. Here is sort of our picture again. Can I get this all on here? Yeah, well, I've got enough of it. I want to talk about making the slope big, make the line close to vertical. Two ways I can do it. The first way, the easiest way to see, is to make x2 be very close to x1. So let's say I leave the x1 here, so I've got this point down here, but I move this x2 very close to x1. What does that do to this point? Well, it moves that point up here. And look at the line. It's connecting this point to this point. Its slope is big. And the closer I move the x2 to the x1, the bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger that slope is going to get. Okay? That's obvious. The second way to make that slope big, and we're going to use that way in a moment, the second way is to make the x2 go to infinity. I claim as x2 goes to infinity, then the slope gets big. I don't care what happens to the y1. If the x2 goes to infinity, the slope will get big. Now, you could, if you can picture these things well, you could see this by the picture, but it's a little hard because remember that curve, as it gets bigger and bigger, it's steeper and steeper. It's kind of hard to picture way out there, way up there. So I will give you an algebraic proof that as x2 goes to infinity, the slope goes to infinity. It's an easy algebraic proof in high school algebra. There's my slope. And I want to talk about the case. We've done this case by the picture. Now the case that x2 goes to infinity. Well, there's my slope. I'm going to make that fraction smaller by I throw that plus y1 away at the top. That makes it smaller. I add an x1 on the bottom. That makes the denominator bigger. It makes it smaller. So this slope is bigger than this. But this equaled that. And we already saw that the top there, as x2 went to infinity, that top went to the square root of x cubed. Okay. When I first showed that picture, I talked about that. Okay, as x2 goes to infinity, this is that are almost the same. But that equals that, and that goes to infinity. So this is getting very close to this, going to infinity. That's staying bigger. It's got to go to infinity. Okay. All right. Now, I now claim that S contained, remember what was S? S was the X's giving me a rational right triangle. An alpha of X, beta of X, gamma of X being a rational right triangle. And we already saw that S contains infinitely many numbers. I now want to show that it contains arbitrarily large numbers. Well, suppose not. Suppose there is an upper bound, so capital B. So nothing in S, no X in S is bigger than capital B. Well, that means everything in S is crammed inside that finite interval. And there's infinitely many points in S. So I've got infinitely many points crammed inside that finite interval. Now, I could be sophisticated and say, for those of you who have real analysis, that means there must be an accumulation point. But I don't need to say that. I can make it more elementary. I can say, look, suppose you have an interval of length 7, and you cram a whole bunch of numbers in there. I claim infinitely many numbers in there. I claim that 2 of them must be closer than 1 over a million, and 2 must be closer than 1 over a billion, and 2 must be closer than 1 over a trillion. Why? Well, suppose no 2 are closer than 1 over a million, and the interval is length 7. How many points can you cram into an interval of length 7 where no two of them are closer than 1 over a million? At most, 7 million. Or maybe 7 million and 1 if you use the endpoints. But we've got infinitely many. So two of them are closer than a million. 1 over a million. 2 are closer than 1 over a billion. 2 are closer than 1 over a trillion. Okay, so I can find an S, I can find an X1 and an X2 as close together as I want. What happened to the slope of my line when x2 was very close to x1? It went towards infinity. It got arbitrarily large. Okay? So if I pick x1 and x2, both in S, and very, 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 very close together, then this lambda becomes very big. Okay? Everybody happy? But what about that? Well, those are both bounded by this alleged bound B. So that sum cannot get big. It can't get bigger than 2b. Well, there's my x3. It's something very, very, very big squared. Subtract something small. It gets very, very, very big as x1 and x2 get close to each other. Eventually, it's going to get bigger than this bound b. Okay? So now we know that S contains numbers bigger than a million, bigger than a trillion, trillion, trillion factorial. Okay, good. Now, I'm now going to switch over here and do the blackboard. We come now to the, we have all the pieces we need. And I want to show that S is dense in the integers bigger than the numbers, the real numbers bigger than N. So pick a random X prime. X prime. There's a random number bigger than N. I want to convince you that there must be something in S as close to X prime as you would like. Well, suppose there isn't. Suppose there is some interval around X prime and nothing in S is inside that interval. I will show that cannot happen, no matter how small your interval is. In fact, I will show that there's something in the left. I don't even need the right part. I'll show there's something in S in this left-hand part of that interval. Suppose I'm wrong. Suppose there is such an interval and nothing in S is inside it. Let's make that interval as big as possible. Maybe I can make the number bigger, and I'm still wrong. Okay? Let's make it as big as I can get, and with still being wrong. Maybe make it as big as this. But I can't make it any bigger. So maybe this is an open interval, maybe, and that boundary there I will call X. The assumption is X is inside this open interval. Interval from opening up to here, and that endpoint is X sub 1. Now, what forced me to stop? There's two ways I could stop. I'd be forced to stop. Maybe X sub 1 equals N. I run out of room. Then, if I made it any bigger, X 1 would contradict saying there's nothing in S inside there. So, there are two possibilities. X sub 1 is in S or it equals N. And the third possibility, maybe X is not X sub 1 getting closer and closer and closer and closer and closer. And X sub 1 is a limit point of things in S. Okay? Then again, if I made this into any video, it would be filling S. Those are the three ways that X1, that I'm forced to stop at X1. Okay. I will now show how I get my nice little contradiction and show that there must be something in S inside that interval. So I go down here to the point X1 minus Y1. And I draw a vertical line right up there. And I go up here to the point X prime, Y prime, and I draw line. Those straight lines. Now, what do I do next? I forget what I do next. What I do next is let's assume that we are in one of these two cases. This third case will be here. Okay. So let's assume that either X1 is an S or here. If either of these is true, it tells me that this is a rational point. Remember, if X1 is an S, then X, Y was a rational point. Or if X equals N, then I really have N, 0. Okay? So if we assume that it's one of these two possibilities, then I have that this is a rational point. Now, I'm going to pick an X sub 2 in S that's very big, huge, monstrously huge. And I can do that. We've already seen there's arbitrarily large things in S. So pick a huge, a monstrously huge X sub 2 in S. So where is it? Well, it's way out here, way hugely out here along the x-axis, and then way hugely up there along the y. We can't really picture it. It's too far away. But we can picture the line connecting it to this point. And what do I know about the slope of that line? When X sub 2 goes to infinity, what happens to the slope of that line? It goes to infinity. I can make it bigger than the slope of this line. That is going to be my line. And this is going to X sub 2, Y sub 2. It takes a heck of a long time to get there because X sub 2 is so far that way and so far that way. It's going to, you know, we've got to go out a long, 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 long way before you bump into there, but it's there. Okay? Now, we're assuming we're in this case, meaning this is a rational point. And We also assume that x sub 2 was an S. Meaning that this is a rational point. Where's my x sub 3? Where's my x sub 3, y sub 3?
In between x1 and x prime.
Yeah, I mean, remember, in that picture I said, you can interchange the x sub 2, y sub 2, and the x sub 3, y sub 3. That's what I've done, because I'm assuming the x sub 2 is so big. What I had in the earlier picture, my big x sub 3, y sub 3 is really my x sub 2, y sub 2. And this becomes the x sub 3, y sub 3. But this point is rational, and that point is rational. And since two of them are rational, that makes this one rational. And my x sub 3, and there it is, x sub 3, and it's an F because it's a rational point and is inside an interval. And we have a contradiction. Isn't that pretty? What about the third case, where this is not an x sub 1, but it's a limit of things in S sub 1? I leave that to you. Do the obvious thing. Replace this point down here by something in S very, 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 very close to it. And you're going to point down here, rational, very close to this one, and then connect, replace the original line with this line, and those two lines are so close together, and the crossing point is going to be very close to that one, and it's going to be, okay? So just do it by approximation, okay? And that basically is the proof. And it's this wonderfully visual elementary proof. It is very sophisticated mathematics in some sense, yet utterly elementary. If you'll bear with me for two more minutes, I will show you something of interest. Remember, when I first proved that there's infinitely many rational right triangles of area N, I started with this one, looked like that, and then I had this one, and then I said, starting with this one, you can then get a third one. I remember that notation I had earlier. Well, each one of those corresponds to a point on my curve. Suppose this one corresponds to that point, and this one to that point, and this one to that point. What's the relationship between those points? I did not know this, what I'm going to show you. I did not know it. Remember I said I discovered that magic formula, that elephant? Later on, when I learned about the connection to this curve, I said, oh, maybe the curve shows me a nice way of finding a connection. Well, here's what it is. If this is my first one, I take the tangent line right there, and guess what? It intersects at the second triangle. And then, to get the third triangle, I take the tangent line here, and it intersects down here. Oh, that's on the negative half. I don't like the negative half. I want to be the positive half. So I simply jump up here. And that's the third one. And to find the point corresponding to the fourth triangle, I would take this tangent line, and it would intersect about here somewhere, and that would give me the fourth triangle, and then I would take that tangent line, and it would intersect down here somewhere, but I would jump up here, and that would give me the fifth triangle, and so on. Okay? So isn't that all kind of lovely? If you want to learn more about this, I do recommend the Conrad paper, and I thank you for your attention. Questions? Huh? Pizza? Hey, pretty good. Under an hour. I didn't know I could talk so fast. Actually, I did know I could talk so fast.